This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's flip it around. Same case, Nancy Guthrie, same evidence, but this time we're hunting for the holes, and the investigation has left plenty. The crime scene was so loose that a reporter, Brian Anton, and his photographer walked right up to the front door because they could. Because it was waved over. Because he's a great reporter and a wonderful reporter. And there was nobody saying don't. And there was no tape up saying don't. The cadaver dog searches got shut down early. The sheriff who ran the whole thing has a perjury referral sitting on the state attorney general's desk. So the question here is ugly but fair. Did the investigation already wreck the case against whoever ends up being blamed, guilty or not? That's what I want to dive into deeper from a defense perspective. Not the horror of the DA and the prosecutor going, this is going to be fun. But from the defense perspective, how much of a cakewalk might this be or not? I mean, the sheriff who ran this swore under oath, Nanos, he'd never been suspended as a cop. Then records came out showing he was more than once. His own county referred him to the AG for perjury. Obviously, not at all connected to Nancy Guthrie. This happened decades ago. But if you're the defense, what does that give you about everything in this case, if anything?
Oh, gosh. You know, if I'm defense, I'm having a field day with that. I'm starting my opening statement with something like, you know, horrible judgment, fatal mistakes, perjury. You think I'm talking about the defendant? No. I'm talking about the police in this case. Like that. Like it is so glaring in terms of how it affects the credibility of the investigation, that even if they do reach a suspect, even if they do find a body, I think that there are so many chasms in this investigation into which reasonable doubt can fit. And I think that the defense will be very well postured.
So, Eric, on the same sad track, they made a number of SWAT raids early on as well. Does that play into the lack of credibility of law enforcement that defense will use, or does that get ignored? Like, how does that play into it as well also?
SWAT raids of the Guthrie house?
No. So they thought they had someone, and they rolled out lights, sirens, you know, code ones down the street to the houses. And they're like, "What? Who are you? Who are the Guthries?" And in other words, they went to houses with some real false leads. Does that play into their credibility also, or is that just kind of par for the course for the types of cases like this?
Yeah, for sure. And I think we're going to get into that even more deeply. But, you know, one thing I'd say is to the jury, you know, when law enforcement marshaled all of these personnel and they got all these SWAT vehicles and they're going to this house and they really believe they got the guy. You know what? They believe so much that they had him then. They have that same belief now for this guy. They were patently wrong then. They're patently wrong now. You cannot believe any sort of position they're taking in terms of who they think did this.
Okay, let's do that again. I want to put a spotlight on you. And then I want you to have like a staff or something. And then let be real dramatic. Let's do that line one more night.
That's good.
Because yes, I like that. I mean that's true. I mean it seems very, very scary for whoever did this. If in fact they do catch the right person, they have fairly good odds here. The reporter, Brian, who walked right up to Nancy's front door because he could. Internet sleuths were wandering the property. The crime scene was not secured in the very early hours, the very key moments where you need it to be secured. What the hell was going on in those conversations between Nanos, between the DA as they're looking at this? I mean, I can't imagine anybody with any sort of sense is like, oh, this looks like it's going swimmingly. I mean, I what the hell do you think is happening on the legal side and the law enforcement side? It feels like there's quite a disconnect. I know you said, you know, and a lot of times you got each other's cell phone numbers. You're working hand in hand. Does this feel like this is a hand in hand operation with the local DA and Nanos?
It does not. And usually when there is a homicide, at least when I was a prosecutor in Colorado, we would go out to the scene and we would be, like I said, we'd be on the same page with law enforcement. And if we saw something that was problematic, like, hey, you haven't secured this scene yet. Hey, you haven't developed a perimeter. Hey, there are people just walking in and out of your perimeter here. That's problematic. It's going to be a problem for the evidence later on. You got to stop that. That's the kind of communications I would have. I don't know if the prosecutor was not present or if one was present, they didn't see any issue, or if they did see an issue and didn't want to speak up, and or if the sheriff was sort of taking the reins and said, hey, don't worry, I got this. Like, we'll handle this piece of it. You guys do the courtroom stuff. I'm just wondering if some of those issues came up.
I mean, I'm not going down a conspiracy route here by any means, but it almost feels like this was a crime scene that was intentionally contaminated. I mean, I guess on the outside it feels like that, but as a defense attorney, Eric, and as a former prosecutor, how often from the legal standpoint do you look at this and kind of feel that way about cases where it's like, guys, come on, this ain't your first rodeo. It's not like you arrest them and they're in jail forever. There's a legal component to this. Can we get our shit together and not destroy the scene? Is that just kind of more common than we want to admit to ourselves out here as lay people?
You know, I remember a case, Tony, when I was a prosecutor and I was sort of naive and green. I had all these rosy notions of the system being for justice and they're always doing the right thing. And then I was assigned a third DUI case, and the defendant was a police officer. It was a third DUI. And I'm looking at the case and I'm saying, God, they didn't even do these roadside maneuvers right. And they kind of just like called it in. They didn't do anything in detail. They didn't document things well. That they gave the guy every sort of pass they could have. They didn't do the chemical test advisement correctly. That they didn't administer the test correctly. Ultimately, it was refusal. But at that point, I realized that investigation had been botched and they were covering for that guy, is my sincere belief. Can't say that's happening here, but I can say that that happens. And I've seen it.
You know, everyone's been talking about how the speed and lack of speed that Nanos involved the FBI in this. Again, it's not FBI's jurisdiction, but as a supporting role, there's a lot of resources that were ignored and not utilized early on in this, crime scene handling being one of them, potentially, as well as DNA labs and all that. But now on the legal side, prosecution side, how quickly are you expecting when a homicide like this happens? Like, in other words, what goes on behind the scenes? Do you, as a prosecutor, are you reaching out for law enforcement right away, or you hear it in the news and you're waiting for them to be contacted? In other words, do you think there's a delay involving the prosecution or prosecutor as well? Because, and my only question in this is, like, they needed loving critics on this that they did not have to help direct, you know, some chaos on the ground. Now, granted, we know that Nanos removed his lead investigator. It was a more junior person that was put on lead on this. And so if you're having that, you're looking for some objective help and you know, someone from the outside to help direct this. Prosecutors, how soon did they get involved in these things? And do you think there was a delay?
Highly doubt there was any delay. When I was prosecutor, we would always have someone on homicide call. I've done it a bunch of times. I got called out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you get up and you go. And so it would be shocking to me if there was significant prosecutorial delay.
Do you think that they did that right away, or could they have stonewalled the prosecutors from being involved like they did the FBI? Or because there's just, you saw all the ground chaos.
Yeah, it's at least possible, but it would just be very unlikely. Most prosecutorial systems, that person's on call, they get that call, they're up and out the door within 10 minutes.
The FBI, Kash Patel in interviews has said they got locked out early on and then brought in. Sheriff's office talking about a key piece of hair that is still being tested all these months later. They tested it at some lab in Florida instead of at Quantico. now it's being tested again somewhere. I don't know exactly the whereabouts of the hair, and they're trying to figure out exactly what type of DNA to pull off of it. If they can pull DNA off of it, it's taking some time. If let's say we get down to a piece like this where it is just a small piece of DNA. I mean, look at like the Koberger case. You have that little piece of DNA on the knife sheath. This in some ways reminds me of that, depending on what results they end up getting back. How admissible is it if it's been transferred from here to there? Obviously, chain of custody is a big thing. I mean, has this piece of damage or has this piece of evidence already been tainted too much to ever make it into the courtroom? Or do these sort of things happen sometime where the locals send it to their lab and then it goes to the FBI? Does it matter where it goes? Or is this a lot of noise that doesn't mean much?
Oh, it definitely matters. I don't think it is so compromised that it would be inadmissible, but I think that it would be certainly challengeable at the trial phase. One thing that would matter is the meticulousness of the documentation concerning the transfers, concerning the whereabouts, when it happened, how it happened, the packaging within which it was transported. All of those things really matter and can be certainly attacked on cross-examination from defense.
Yeah, to me, I think it's just going to be the delay that it took to get from one lab to the other lab, because labs are pretty much labs. I know everyone wants to go on the FBI side. They should have sent it to the FBI. But if they got a relationship with another lab, I don't know how fast one processes versus the others, because then you got to prioritize and it gets messy. But it, like you said, Eric, it all comes down to that documentation, chain of custody. As long as everything was done well, it shouldn't matter, except it's the speed of getting the results as people are running away and getting further away as you're waiting those results. I think that's what was really the hindrance here, potentially.
Whoever, if they get somebody, whoever is caught in this, are they going to have their choice of pretty much the best attorneys in the country? It's not going to necessarily be, here's your public defender. Because, I mean, is this a case where, you know, people are already salivating, where high power attorneys already have their teams working on how they're going to pitch this as I'm your best representative to whoever they may catch? Because, look, we already got the case. We got all this. We're ready to go. We've been studying this from the ground up. What kind of influx of defense support should the person who eventually gets caught, if they get caught, expect?
Totally. So, you know, I contrast it with the White House dinner shooter case, where that's a high profile case, could get you a lot of attention. That case sucks, man. It's on video. The dude's taking selfies with the weapons and everything. Even if you get some sort of notoriety from it, you're probably going to lose and it's going to suck. Whereas this one, the case is super defensible. The case is good. So not only is there notoriety and fame, but there is, you know, people are chomping at the bit to get on it on the defense side, because it appears so far to be incredibly defensible. And I would imagine that the top names throughout the country are certainly aware of it and probably would make themselves available for a consultation, you know, at a moment's notice, hop on a plane, they'd be there.
So what would make it more less defensible? If so, you know, let's again do a hypothetical conjecture here. So say they find Nancy, they find and an autopsy confirms her manner of death. They find DNA on her matching a suspect that they actually capture, but he doesn't confess. Is that still, with all these holes, if you have all those three things, body, DNA, and human being that did it, how's that weigh in? Is that still something a defense attorney would take because they think they could still defend it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, the DNA thing, if that were established, would be compelling. But you look into, what is the explanation for that DNA finding? Is there any possibility of a false positive? Is there any possibility of the processing being so incompetent that the finding is inadmissible? Is there any possibility of planting evidence? Is there any possibility of some accident, like this person happened to be in the locale at a, you know, they both went to a Starbucks around the same, you know, there are just things that you got to look into. So would not be a nail in the coffin by any means.
In other words, so all the potholes they created along the way have really undermined their ability on the prosecution side to actually have a good case, no matter what happens from this point, correct?
It would seem like that, although it's still potentially provable based on what would could transpire. But yes,
this is, I mean, the question that always comes up, and we're far from getting here yet, but how difficult is it going to be to find an unbiased jury in this case if you're to test it right there in Pima County?
Yeah, that's tough because not only is it, of course, a nationally publicized case, but there's already fame involved because of Guthrie's daughter and who she is. But you know, the prosecution might have some hurdles in terms of finding a fair and impartial juror, due in part to the criticism of the law enforcement and of the investigation. Usually it's the defense worried about, hey, they're going to send my guy, you know, to the gallows because of all this publicity. I think that that same concern is on the prosecution side, if not more so.
Well, I mean, it's disturbing. And I'm thinking of that just because I'm watching some of the comments here and there's so many, so much confirmation bias. I mean, I'm watching someone going like, what? Where did you go down this road? Like, how did you get here? And I'm not faulting anybody. There's so much information out there. I mean, unless you're doing this for a living like we do, it's hard to keep track of all of it. So it's very easy to go down rabbit holes or just to go down paths that you think this is legitimate information and it's not. And so people, I mean, my God, this is probably one of the biggest cases where so many people think they know what happened based on somebody else's conjecture that was based on somebody else's conjecture that was based on somebody's conjecture of their cousin's cat, Susie's dog's aunt's caretaker. You know, it's that vast and it goes in so many directions. That's got to be a very difficult thing when trying to select a jury to try and wade into, hey, what do you know about the case? And what is an acceptable amount of knowledge to have on a case, Eric, that can let them be on a jury as an impartial juror without being completely oblivious of everything that's going on?
Yeah. So, really, the metric is not exactly knowledge. So knowledge is a proxy for having an opinion. You have to have knowledge in order to have an opinion. But but a person, in theory, can have a ton of knowledge about reports in a case. And so long as they have not developed an opinion as to guilt, an opinion as to the competency of the investigation, so long as they have just passively received that knowledge, then in theory, they could be led on the jury. But in practice, any human being who has received such knowledge, I think, would instinctively draw their own conclusions.
Let me throw this one at you. What if you're interviewing somebody? I don't know how this process works. I've never been a juror. So you're interviewing jurors and they don't have an opinion, but I heard it was this, this, and this, and it's like nothing to do with reality. Insert just totally disprovable bullshit here. And they don't have an opinion, but it's like, I heard about that. Is that like a red flag? Is that like, okay, you're out because you've absorbed this and you're recalling it? Or is that a good juror who's just taken some stuff in, but that seems to be what stuck and it's not remotely part of reality?
Yeah, for me, it would be a tremendous red flag because what it means is they have a misapprehension about what the evidence might be. And that misapprehension could cause them to negatively view what the actual evidence is. And so, I would think that would be grounds to strike a juror if they, you know, adopted this.
Adopted,
these falsehoods about the case.
I mean, adopted and just, I'm not paying attention, but here's what I heard in passing are two different things, though. You know,
I'm curious about this angle.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about this angle when it comes to jurors. I've sat on jury, and my wife sat one last year, and one of the things that's interesting when they're doing all the questioning, one of the cops that made the arrest, actually her kids were where my wife works. And so she knew by default this cop. And so that became a thing that was she's being questioned about. And so in this case, it might not. I'm curious, Eric, what you think, whether it would be disqualifying or not, because I think more people might know about Nanos's reputation as sheriff than they might know about this case because of how contentious he is. would that be a potential jury question about what they think about the sheriff and his conduct just as sheriff? And would you use that as either a qualifier or disqualifier? Or do you think it'd even come up?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yes, it would absolutely come up in jury selection. And whether it be disqualifying is depends on the side you're on. So if it depends on what the answer is, you know, but if I'm prosecution, I'm fronting that and I'm saying, hey, look, I don't get to choose who my sheriff is and I don't get to choose what they do. What I get to do is present a case in which I believe strongly where we have evidence of guilt. So you kind of have to soften that how it's going to land for them. And you can do that in jury selection. You can do it in opening statement and throughout the trial. But that issue will be front of mind. And if folks have drawn a conclusion that this investigation was botched or just incompetent or whatever, if I'm prosecution, I'm getting them out of there. If I'm the defense, I'm begging to have them stay.
Yeah, so think about this. His entire conduct is the thing that could, you know, even if they got the guy that did this, his entire conduct could actually completely undermine this entire thing.
Yeah. It's like a potential get out of jail free card. I mean, as close as we can get to having one, really. And that's why, again, you cross your T's, you dot your I's, and you, I think more importantly in this case, it's not even about just crossing the T's and dotting the I's. It's understanding what a T is. It's understanding what an I is and how to use them in a sentence. And I think that metaphorically is a problem that Nanos has always suffered from. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.